When most people say ghetto, they mean unrefined, low class, cheap, or inferior, especially when it comes to Black people.
At least until it's co-opted by everybody else and suddenly becomes pop culture.
But we're reclaiming ghetto and rejecting white supremacist norms regarding how we're supposed to look, think, or be.
And we aren't waiting for Black ingenuity to be colonized to celebrate it. Absolute means to the largest degree possible, having unlimited power and influence, or simply unrestrained.
I'm Malcolm.
I'm Sade. And this is... Well, this is my little sister, Lola. She's about to bring it home for y'all. What this is, Lola?
This is...
What is up, everybody? Welcome back to The Absolute Ghetto. And we're here with our first movie review, aren't we?
That's right. We decided to watch a nice little Black movie in honor of Black History Month, or Black Liberation Month to some.
So I bet y'all can guess what movie, well, you probably already saw this title, so you already know. But the movie is One Night in Miami, of course. If you don't know, it is a fictional story told about civil rights leaders, Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali. Is he considered a civil rights leader?
Yeah.
Jim Brown, the NFL player, and Sam Cooke, the singer. So all four of them, basically, it's like a fictional night, and they end up all meeting in a hotel room after Muhammad Ali, who at the time hadn't changed his name to Muhammad Ali yet, so he was still referred to as Cassius Clay throughout the movie. He had just won a big title against Sonny Liston, and they all think they're going to go out to celebrate, but It turns out that Malcolm X had invited them back to his little motel room to basically talk.
Right.
Just to talk. And they weren't very happy about that, right? Because as Jim Brown said, he was trying to get some pussy.
That's, you know, they're trying to like be guys. He said, I'm trying to have a good time. I'm not here for all this rah-rah shit. But you know, it is what it is.
But y'all know Malcolm. Y'all know Malcolm will have you, you know, he'll have you out here analyzing your whole life. Mm-hmm. He had to do what he had to do, I guess. So they spend most of the movie in this hotel room basically talking, but it's pretty interesting because it's like they have all these conversations about their role in the civil rights movement and the future, like the hope of the future, where their careers could go, where their influence could go, what they could do with their influence. Sometimes they're kind of clashing over what they should do with their influence. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's just like it's a fictional account. The night didn't actually happen.
There is a picture. Like, they definitely met up. But as far as like the details of their conversation, that's what has been left to the interpretation of the screenwriters of this particular film.
Yeah.
After watching the movie, like we watched it separately and we kind of gave each other space to like make our own interpretation of the movie, and then we brought it back together.
I guess the question that we want to ask is like, does this matter? Does this movie matter? So I'll explain my reasoning behind asking this question. So this is a fictional portrayal of real people. And it's interesting because it's kind of like an algorithm. It's like the screenwriters, they're like the algorithm absorbing all this knowledge we have about these people, their interviews, performances, every little thing that we have of them that we have left of them. We're taking it and we're sort of like putting it into this movie and like sort of crafting these performances, basically putting words in their mouth, you know, of what we think would have happened. And keep in mind, this was 1964, so kind of like smack dab in the middle of the civil rights movement. And also, this was the year, almost exactly a year before Malcolm X was assassinated. So that sort of like maybe like orient the time for you a little better if you didn't see the movie yet. But basically, I kind of said it's kind of like AI in movie form, like artificial intelligence. Like we're kind of like...
Like the thing is that like obviously... those who don't know their history are doomed to repeat it. That's something that I'm sure a lot of, especially Black folk, have heard that at some point. And so I think it's we both, Sade and I, agree that it's important for us to know about the history, to know what some of these, like, larger-than-life Black figures, what they thought, how they approached life, what their ideology was. But at the same time, that's where this question and why I think it's important is, like, what is the purpose, one, of having a fictional account of these real people? And then the second part of that is there something that we can learn from it?
Because it's so important that, like, we tell the stories of people who have led these movements, who have contributed to change, who have influenced generations and things like that. And sort of like, I think, like, the premise of why we think it's so important to tell these stories is because they're true stories. Like Malcolm said, if you don't know your history, you're doomed to repeat it. We can learn from our history so that we can keep moving forward and not go back. But is it important, quote unquote, to tell the stories of the same leaders that, like, are not true? Like, is that important? You know, people always say, oh my God, this is so important. Like, you know, like, this is an important conversation to have. These are really important things to talk about. You know, like, is this important? Because it didn't happen. So just chew on that for a minute, and we're going to come back to that question at the end.
But first, we got to talk about the movie. So spoiler alert, spoiler warning. If you have not watched the movie and you do not want to be spoiled, go ahead and stop right now. Press pause. It will be here when you come back.
We encourage you
to watch it. Yeah, it's nice little 2 hours. You can break it up and come right back and listen to us, you know, talk about it.
I'll say, let's take a quick break and we'll be right back to go into what we thought about the movie and then go into some themes that really stood out to us.
And we're back. So let's go ahead and get into it with our initial reactions to the movie. So before, actually, I want to say shout out to Regina King, the legendary Regina King. She don't miss. This was her directorial debut, and I think it was an awesome one. And also, I just love her work in general. So I was super excited to see the movie.
For a movie like this to be Black woman directed is pretty cool, because I feel like a lot of the, like, historical Black films we've seen, of course, this is a fictional one, so a little bit different. But regardless, a lot of the stories we see about Black history are directed by Black men, sometimes white men. I don't see it very often where it's a Black woman directed, like, Black history piece. So that's pretty cool. Let's start with, did we like it? What do you rate it, Malcolm?
So if I was rating this movie on a scale from 1 to 10, I would give it an 8. It takes a little bit to get going. Like, I was like, all right, okay. Yeah. And then, like, we get launched, and they spend a lot of time in the setup, which I think is important. But, like, I was ready for these conversations to happen, the fictional conversations. But I was ready. I was like, all right, I want to see these people, you know, hashing it out with each other. And I feel like it took a long time personally for it to get to that. But I feel like, why I ranked the movie highly is that it definitely had me thinking. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the conversations felt highly relevant. I feel like Sade and I be having conversations like this all the time. I be having conversations all the time with, like, my friends about stuff like this.
It was very
relatable in many ways. I think the writers did a really good job in bringing the story to life in that way, where it's like you have these different issues. You have these complex people trying to just figure out how they fit in. So, yeah, I would say that I did like the movie.
Okay. Well, I would say, on a scale of 1 to 10, I would give it a 7. A 7. Maybe a 7.5. I didn't mind the pacing. It was a little slow for me, but I understand why. Like, I already knew going in, like, most of the movie was going to take place kind of, like, in one place. So, regardless of the pacing, it was just the content was really good. Like, just the creativity that you have to sort of even come up with this concept. And that you can tell they really took care to tease out the nuances of, like, who these people are. Mm-hmm. And the sides that we don't get to see so much, even. And the nuances of, like, their friendships and their relationships with each other, because these people did know each other in real life. And, like, so they were friends in real life. So, like, Malcolm and Muhammad Ali mm-hmm. were close, and so were the others. Like, they all knew each other, so it was cool to see. So that's why I give it a good rating, and I think they did do a good job of taking creative liberty but still staying true to who these people were in real life. So did you have a favorite scene?
So I think my favorite scene had to be when Malcolm is doing a flashback of, like, the show. I want to say it's in Chicago. Sam Cooke, so when he went to Sam Cooke's show in Chicago, basically he had got sabotaged, and he had, like, the sound was down, and so he had to, like, improvise to make it happen. And he basically started, like, this, like, chant with the audience, And it was like a call and response type thing, you know, super completely, you know, absolute ghetto, like our stuff, black people. How everyone got kind of like sucked into it. And it just showed like how, and I like the part because like this scene takes place like when they're kind of duking it out ideologically. And like, mm-hmm. this was Malcolm's way of being like, I love you. Like, I respect you a lot. And the reason that I'm on your ass is because I love you. You know what I mean? Like, this is not coming from a place of malice. And I just love that sheer appreciation in a way that, like, the other people in the room are like, we didn't know all of that. Like, we knew he could sing. We knew that. You know what I mean? But, like, we didn't know he was out here starting, you know, spiritual chants with people. I really liked that part because it kind of gave a, because the movie had got like, the air had got really tense. I was like, Jesus Christ. And then like, it kind of like brought it back into like, we're all in this together. And also real quick, Jim Brown, when they first started arguing, he was like, I see y'all got the high style. He was like, basically, he was like, if anybody comes for me, you gonna get hurt. And I like that too. he said, y'all can play around if you want to, but you try me, you might get hurt. But what was yours?
I like that scene. I think my favorite scene was, I did like the part when Malcolm went to go on the phone, went to call his wife in the phone booth, and his daughter ended up picking up, so they ended up talking for a minute, and then he ends up talking to his wife. That part kind of stood out to me because, I mean, honestly, I think it stood out to me because when I think of Malcolm X, like, I don't even think about his family. It's weird. Like, for example, like, Martin Luther King, it seemed like his family was, like, always connected to him, like, his children and his wife, like, just seeing, I mean, of course, it's a fictional account, but like, just give like that side of him. And like, one thing I liked about the movie a lot in general was the way that they continuously humanized, you know, each of these like larger than life figures. Just the way that he was talking to her, and like the way, like, he already knew the way she was going to stand up. Like, he told her, like, oh, hop off your stool. Like, he already knew she was sitting on the stool, and he already knew she was gonna like turn this way. And he said, take 3 steps this way, turn left. Like, he had the book with the note in it ready for her. Like, it was just like a nuanced moment that was just like, it was one of the most humanizing moments in the film for me. So that might have been one of my favorite scenes.
Oh, I love that. I loved how you described it. Like, it reminded me, because that wasn't, I remember the scene, but I wasn't impacted the same way, but you made me feel it. I loved how you described it.
Well, thank you. I think we wanted to talk a little bit too about some of like the creative merits of the film and how it stood out to us there. Speaking of scenes that stood out, the cinematography for me was so spot on in the scene where Jim Brown, well, if you, we're gonna talk about this a little bit later too, but might as well bring it up now because it is it is a moment.
yeah
But basically, he goes to see an old family friend, and Jim Brown, he had just finished the NFL, so now he's trying to become an actor. So he went back home to Georgia and ends up visiting a family friend, and the family friend is a white family, so he ends up talking out on the porch with his family friend, and they get served some lemonade and all of that, and they're just, you know, talking it up, catching up and stuff, and they seem like, you know, good old friends. And he's singing all his praises. He's saying like, the great Jim Brown, like, I know the great Jim Brown and all this stuff. And then he had to move some furniture, and his granddaughter comes out and is like, oh, can you remember to move this, like, just when you get a chance? He's like, oh yeah, let me just go ahead and do it now. So he goes to do it, and this is an older white man, you know, at least probably in his 60s. And Jim Brown is like, oh, you need me to help you with that? And he turns around, he steps into the house, and Jim Brown is standing on the outside of the house. So he's on the porch, but he's standing outside the door. And so his friend steps into the house, so he's standing on the inside of the door, and he turns and looks back at him, and he says, oh, you know, we don't allow niggers in the house.
And I was just like, what in the world?
He was like, thanks, but you know we don't allow niggers in the house. So he walks off to go, you know, he says goodbye and walks off to go move the furniture, I guess. And Jim Brown is just standing there in the doorway. And the way, like, the camera, like, kind of pulls back. The camera pulls back on the inside of the house. So it kind of, like, pans away from him. So he's getting smaller. And you're seeing more of the inside of the house. And he's, like, kind of standing in the doorway as it's, like, kind of, like, dark silhouette. And it was just like, it was a really good camera moment. It just captured the emotion that I can imagine you would feel in that moment, like, oh, so close, but mm-hmm. no cigar. Or you could tell in that moment he thought maybe it's not going to be like that anymore because I've reached this point. But the way they captured it visually was really spot on. Devastating scene, devastating line, but the way that they executed it was really great. So that's a cinematography moment that stood out for me. Is there any
other creative choices that like stood out?
Casting. I know you said that you didn't like Malcolm X's casting. You said he wasn't fine enough.
He wasn't fine enough. No, he was not. You know, yeah, I didn't fine. Think I that's thought the casting rude. I would say on a talent level, I feel mm-hmm. like they all did what they had to do. I feel like Muhammad Ali, specifically or Cassius Clay, like I feel like he really had the accent now.
That could have been Muhammad Ali straight up.
I mean they did really good. Like Muhammad Ali and Sam Cooke like looked kind of like the actual people, which you know that's not all that goes into the casting. It's also like making sure that they can like deliver the feeling of who these people are.
And just to put some names to these actors, it was the person who played Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, was Eli Gorey. I hope I'm saying that right. Mm-hmm. And then Sam Cooke's actor was Leslie Odom Jr. And then we had Kingsley Ben-Adir as Malcolm X. I guess you didn't fuck with that so much. You didn't fuck with the way he was looking. You didn't think he was spot on enough. I thought he kind of looked similar. No, not to you.
Was he the same as the people that the internet be thirsting over? And let me stop. I'm just being messy. you know, niggas really be losing their mind over Malcolm X.
All I know is on the day that we all got our powers on December 21st, everyone was teleporting back to 1960s so they could fuck Malcolm with y'all little nasty asses. I didn't go. I personally was in Tulum ghettoing it up, but y'all do what y'all need to do.
I see the pandemic has really been getting to folks. Maybe that's like amplified. No, I think honestly, I think they all did a great job. And also on Sam Cooke, the singing. Like I feel like
the actor was really singing in all his scenes.
Mm-hmm. That man is a singer. He sings down. Getting that right alignment between like the acting ability and also the musical ability. And I feel like they did. Mm-hmm. I feel like Sam Cooke did what needed to be done. I found his character really, really appealing in the movie. The last thing I will say is that I feel like their use of tension, like the fact that they kind of confined themselves with having it all, most of the movie taking place in this really small area, how they were able to build up tension, that definitely is a testament to the writer and actors and the director, of course, in that. Like, I feel like even with like there being very little actual physical movement sometimes, and like, you know what I mean? Like they would, through like using camera angles and other, you know, technical things, like I feel like they really accomplished that feeling. Like I really did at certain moments, I was kind of like, oof, Jesus Christ. Like I was like, dang, so they gonna fight now? So I think they did a good job in still giving you a lot of different emotional dynamics.
It was done well.
And so we giving Regina her flowers. I think everyone should be proud of themselves, but now we're going to get into the nitty gritty of the movie.
All right, we're going to be right back to talk about the themes of the movie. All right, we are back. So let's jump right into some of the themes that really stood out to us that were takeaways that we think we're going to hold close to our hearts as we move through Black History Month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to get real deep. So we're going to try our best to unpack it.
Yeah.
You know, with our little Howard degrees, and Sade with her other degree. Since you got your degree, you know everything.
You said the school.
We only recognize HBCUs. This is Black History Month, okay? I don't know. I don't care about that PWI nonsense.
You're right. I have no idea what that school even is.
Listen.
All I know is I got the degree. All right. So the first thing we want to talk about is humanity. So mm-hmm. I really
What do you mean by
like...
that? So yeah. When we say humanity, what are we talking about?
What I really mean is that this movie humanized these larger-than-life characters, legends, leaders for me. They kind of juxtapose we have these larger-than-life figures who are very well-known in the civil rights movement and are still celebrated even today, and they just put them in this shabby hotel room and they sort of strip them down to, like, oh, outside of all the glitz and the, in, you know, being on stage, giving speeches, and the rah-rah and the black power and all that. At the beginning, we even see Cassius Clay winning his matches. We see Malcolm X on TV. Actually, his wife is watching him on TV before he comes in the house, and he comes in the house, and then she turns it off. We see Sam Cooke doing a performance, which he kind of bombed at the beginning, but, you know, that's neither here nor there, because they were white, so they were hating on him.
Just terrible. No taste.
But basically, we see them in all these situations being the leaders that we know, and then they pull all that back, and it's just them stripped down to their real human selves. Like, how much do we really know about them? Like, what do we really regard them as human? Do we consider what happens and when they go home at night? Putting them in this situation humanized them for me.
Mm. So you have, first of all, the setting, which the setting kind of has to do, I think, with the juxtaposition of, like, these people as figures versus them as humans. Where, like, mm-hmm. Malcolm, I mean, all of them kind of took L's at the beginning of the movie.
Did they?
I feel like with each of, they showed each of them taking L's at different times. So you have,
Jim Brown took an L.
We talked about Jim Brown's L in the in that scene. I feel like L is an inappropriate.
That was a big
way
L, or should I say a big N?
Listen,
another big
you're
N.
Doing too much. Mm. I can't stand you. So we have Jim Brown. Jim Brown was going through some stuff. And then we have Muhammad Ali. He was, you know, he was talking all his shit, like how he does. And then he almost got knocked the fuck out.
Almost did, so but he didn't, though.
But he did it. Malcolm X, his beef, I feel like that's trivializing it too much. But he's having his conflict.
He's beefing with the nation.
He's beefing with the nation. It's not going well. And, like, they've heard beefing. And so he's kind
of
lost out.
The nation of Islam, y'all.
Yeah, he's kind of losing out on, like, that platform that he had. They're not fucking with him in the same way. And he's kind of losing some of the privileges that came with that. There's a scene where Sam Cooke comes in. He's like, this is, the fuck is this? Like, walking into the hotel room, he's like, this is dingy. What the fuck is this? And that's kind of showing, because, you know, Malcolm X, I'm sure the nation, they had him booked at first. They had him in the best. But now he's kind of like in this shabby hotel room. And so everyone is kind of coming from this place of, like, where they're seeing the limits of their stardom. They're seeing the limits of these platforms that they are able to utilize, and the influence that they utilize.
And even this motel that they were staying at actually catered to black celebrities, but it really wasn't that nice. If you were seeing that motel today,
quaint is the word. I think it's the best word for
it. It was quaint.
It was giving. What's Motel 6? Keep the light. We keep the light on for you. That's what it was giving me.
Right. Yeah.
Let me stop.
It was giving upscale Motel 6.
They're kind of in a vulnerable moment. Like, the scene puts them in a vulnerable type space.
Right. Damn, Malcolm, you live like this? Well, so usually, like, when we see these figures, a lot of times they're reduced to their highlight reel, the best moments of their life, and then also kind of highlights in the sense of the worst moments of their life. Mm-hmm. So it was just interesting to see, like, this quote-unquote mundane moment. It just allowed us to picture them in a different light. We have these really curated versions of them. And this is like a take on maybe what a not so curated version might be, I think. And it kind of, and it allows them their humanity.
Right. Because a way I was thinking about this is influencers that we have today, like the internet influencers, basically people becoming brands. And like, basically, you're treated as a product that is serving a greater purpose. And I feel like sometimes that's how these leaders are discussed, is like that there's some type of brand. And it doesn't really matter. Like, you have to boil them down. Like, I think that word you use is a great word. It's a curated version of who they are that works with whatever product that you're trying to sell. Like, it's almost like a capitalistic type thing. And it's like, basically, like, this person is reduced to black nationalism, and this person is reduced to, you know, whatever ideology or whatever particular moment. And it doesn't matter, even if the person diverges from that at a certain point, or that's not that label that you're using or that you're trying to like organize them with doesn't even fully describe who they are, because you're using them kind of as leverage for whatever idea that you're trying to discuss.
Right.
And I feel like, you know, like I feel like there's practicality to doing that to a certain degree. Like I get why it happens, but I do think there are significant drawbacks. Like one, of course, is since we're discussing this in the context of humanity, is like that it takes away the humanity of these people. It takes away the fact that they were multifaceted humans that don't fit into neat little categories that sell well and that work well in a hashtag or work well in whatever thing you're trying to do. And so like a scene to tie it back into the movie, I don't know, it kind of made me think of this. There's a part where Sam Cooke and Malcolm are beefing. Sam Cooke kind of talks about, like, he's like, Malcolm's talking, he's like, you sound like the interview, like you sound like how you do in interviews. He was like, you didn't used to be like you used to be a person, is almost kind of what he, how I took it, which, you know, there's other interpretations. And that's just made me think, it made me think about myself and like how sometimes, like, I don't know if other people feel like this, feel free to like give me your own reflection. But like, sometimes I feel like I'm reducing myself. Like I feel like I am trying so hard to be consistent with certain ideals and consistent with theories and whatnot that like I'm not giving myself the room to be fully human. Like I'm not giving myself grace, and by extension, I'm not giving other people grace, which I think is counterproductive in a way. And so that's something that I struggle with. Yeah. Like that really, I felt convicted on that part where he's like, you sound, you know what I mean? Like, he's like, oh, you sound like Malcolm, the Howard nigga. You know what I mean? You sound like you out here, you know what I mean? Talking that bullshit. I don't know if this is the right time to bring it in, because there's this tweet that went viral a while back, because today on Twitter, they've been talking about the best tweets, and this came up as someone's top tweet.
It did?
And that's why I sent it to you. And basically, the tweet's like, I can't stand Howard bitches. Because they'd be in the bathroom arguing, you'd be at the club, they'd be in the club bathroom arguing about slavery. I'm paraphrasing the tweet, but that's basically like more or less what it said. And like, I feel like sometimes, like, not necessarily in the bathroom, because I don't know, I'm not going to talk to you in the bathroom, but like more to the sense, like, I'm like, people are on the streets. Like, there's a part Malcolm literally says, Malcolm X in the movie is like, black people are dying in the streets. And I feel like I'd be saying sometimes, and it's like,
no, for real,
let's calm down, let's look, Shada is calling me out. It's like, okay, let's bring it
for real. And it's hard not to, it's hard not to, as a black person, like, feel like you have to have your woke radar on all the time, because there's just so much to talk about and to rectify. And then at the same time, especially as black people, we're like under a microscope when it comes to scrutiny. Like, you understand why Malcolm X would start to suddenly talk like his interviews. I mean, he's literally being watched by the nation of Islam.
Like what Cohen said, the counterintelligence movie. They literally are tracking him, spying on him, getting information. Yeah, keep going.
Yeah, and you see it through the movie too. Like, he is being spied on, he's being watched. It's like, I would be on edge too. Like, I'd be watching what I say too. But you know, even and like, it bring it to the modern age, think about how we're always being watched. Like, it's like, you know, even with this camera on me right now, because Malcolm and I film on FaceTime, we're gonna start getting them out to you in video format some more. But even like, you know, this camera on me right now, it's like now I don't even know if someone's watching me right now. As black people in general, when it comes to professional settings and things like that, it's so easy to get written off because they're already looking for reasons to write you off. So it makes sense.
I don't want to insinuate that, like, all activism, all radical thoughts are somehow simulated and produced through algorithms. I don't think that's true at all. I feel like it rises from a very authentic and real place. I feel like Malcolm, like, when you read his story, like, Malcolm, you know what I mean? Malcolm lived a full life, Malcolm X. Like, he had been through some stuff, and, like, he learned and he went through that concept of, I mean, that process of ideological refinement is what we call it in black politics, where like you are learning from your mistakes and you're moving forward. I feel like it's not all like talking points, but sometimes it gets hard when you're in the process of that ideological refinement, and when you're trying to find your footing and you're trying to like make like find out what your contribution to the black, like what to your contribution to the black liberation movement is going to be. It is difficult sometimes to like give yourself a break in a way where it's like, it's not that you are being a hypocrite or that you are, you're being less than, like you're not living up to anything, but it's just more of like, you're not going to always be able to be a figure. I'm not trying to insinuate everyone is out here performing. Well, people are to a certain extent, but like it come, you know what I mean? Like I get where it's not all artificial.
But it's not going to be the same as if you were just completely free. True freedom.
Exactly. And another thing, and it's funny because it kind of ties into another concept that we discussed on this podcast of respectability. And we're going to get more into the Nation of Islam, but anyone familiar with the Nation of Islam, they love respectability. And of course, I hate to break it to y'all because I know everyone like idolizes Malcolm X and he can do no wrong. But of course, Malcolm X was a proponent of respectability, and something that like was a very small point of the movie, but like that stood out to me is when they show the part with actually my favorite scene, when they show that flashback of Sam Cooke performing in Chicago and how they discuss Jackie Wilson. And like, I don't know a lot, like maybe Jackie Wilson was out here scamming the kids and sabotaging people. I'm not like trying to stick up for that, but I didn't like how they characterized his music. And like, basically like, they even talked about James Brown this way. It's like, as these people shucking and jiving.
Yeah.
The more lighthearted, as some people would describe it, or the more jovial party music as like being something that's detrimental to black liberation and something that I want to bring in. This is a very like, oh, like this debate's been going on for a long time. Like Karanga, who, you know, is very influential. People know him. Something that a lot of people or that you may know him from is the development of Kwanzaa, of the celebration of Kwanzaa in December. But Karanga wrote this piece basically saying that like black art purely exists for black liberation. And if it's not serving some radical agenda, if it's not inciting people in a certain way, then it's worthless. It's kind of like the thesis of this piece. And I disagree, and lots of people disagree, but like, yeah. I just feel like it to this point, it reduces our humanity. Like, I feel like in part of the struggle, there has to be joy. There has to be, like, we have to have, be able to fully express ourselves as human, because we don't exist purely as struggle bots, as people who are warring against white supremacy.
We literally aren't meant to.
Yeah, you know? We literally aren't like, meant to say that. We literally aren't meant to. And I get that there's a need to. I'm not saying that like we get to just act like white supremacy isn't real and that it's not going to affect us. It's not going to affect the next generation. Like, we need to work. And I think that's the tension.
Yeah, you need, but there to has work. To be balance.
Right.
And not everything you do has to be like bleeding black liberation and black power. Sometimes you can take that load off of yourself.
Right. And but, so it's like, know. And I mean, I would even go as far as to say like our party music and the stuff that makes us feel good, that's having a good time, is part of liberation. And so that's what, like,
literally,
because they even used the word like that Sam Cooke in that scene was gonna class it up, assuming like insinuating that like that like dancing music is like beneath, that it lacks class, it lacks purpose, it lacks meaning. And I feel like it's missing the point of celebration. It's missing the point of how beautiful and multifaceted we are as people.
Imagine if all black art was harking to the struggle. It would be kind of exhausting to consume, wouldn't it?
I still haven't watched that Ava DuVernay movie. Everyone's like, you gotta watch the...
Me neither.
It's
called When They See Us.
Yeah, When They See Us, about the...
I can't watch it.
The Exonerated Six. I can't... Yeah, no, I struggle hard. Like, I literally become mentally fatigued. Like, people can attest to it. Like, I just, like, I have to sit down. Like, I'm just so tired. And so it's like, I don't want anyone... I don't want to hold anyone to that standard where it's like, oh, you out here, did I catch you out here smiling? There ain't shit to smile about, because white people are still at large.
Like I said in our previous episode, they need to be the ones that is not smiling. In the election episode, why are they smiling?
Why are they smiling?
We deserve to smile. Y'all need to get to work.
I feel like there's a lot that we can learn in appreciating their paradoxes, appreciating the ways that they didn't measure up, or that they, you know what I mean, that they were full human beings.
Yeah, so humanity, definitely a big theme to us, or humanization maybe would be a better word. So let's move on to, I don't even know what to call this theme. I just called it high class racism.
I call it, they gonna always remind you a nigger. That's a quote from my dad. My dad told me that, my parents were on some bullshit, but I appreciate them. They told me very early in my life, like, never get too comfortable in white spaces. White people are going to always remind you that you are a part of the oppressed class, that you are not one of them, and that they think you're beneath them.
Yeah, the scene that we already described with Jim Brown, wow, like, that was really a moment that sort of took my breath away. Like, I think I audibly gasped loudly when that happened, because it's like, you could see in his face, the acting was so good too. You could see that it's like, he's sort of cautious with his movements, but you can see that he's reading the room, reading the expressions, trying to see, like, how does this man really feel about me? You know, maybe now that I've gone on to the NFL and I've reached all this success and this status, he won't see me as a nigger. He'll see me as just a man, just like him.
Like, it's a performance, it's an aesthetic. Like, when we talk about, like, the idea of Southern hospitality, which he was in Georgia, that whole idea of Southern hospitality, where they gonna talk shit about you as soon as you leave, but they gonna act real nice in your face.
They really nailed the Southern hospitality sort of aesthetic, too, with the sitting on the front porch talking. A nice lady brings you out some lemonade, some fresh homemade lemonade. They really nailed that moment. I think they set you up perfectly to be shocked if you didn't see it coming when he says, you know, we don't allow niggas in the house.
It was crazy because I was watching this with my boyfriend and we were watching it, and like when he said the part where he was like, I can help you out, I was like, I feel like something racist is gonna happen.
No, for real.
Like, it just, the like cinematography, and like I just felt the tension in my spirit where I was like, something bad is gonna happen.
I thought it was weird that when the woman came out in the first place, that she didn't be like, oh, could you guys? Because, like, usually when it, I mean, with the whole Southern hospitality thing, it's not even one-sided. Like, you know, they give you the niceness and they expect niceness back in return. That's how Southern hospitality kind of works. Like, you know, we're supposed to, like, kind of, it's supposed to be like a mutual thing. So, like, it wouldn't have been odd for her to walk up and be like, oh, since you're here, can you help us move this furniture? You know what I mean? So the fact that she went to this old man first, you know, and was like, oh, can you move this furniture with this NFL player sitting right here who was much younger? That was already a red flag. And the way he asked the question, too, it was almost like, it's kind of, I'm going to connect it. The way he asked the question, he was like, you know, I can help you with that. Or like, or do you say like, do you need help with that? You know, something like that. It's like, he kind of asked it like he was prodding a little bit, or like, because then the next line that comes is, you know, we don't allow niggers in the house. And the word that stood out to me was, you know. So that means he already knew how these people are. And like, him even asking the question, he already knew like what the answer could be, but like, he was hoping that he had reached that status now that he wouldn't be treated like that. So like, he already knew, but he was like, maybe this time. It's been years. Maybe this time, you know, I have NFL titles. Maybe this time,
right?
You know,
and he's like, I've broken records. Like, I'm a legendary player. Like, I am the best. You know what I mean? And I think, I also wanted to highlight like how the characters portrayed in the movie is that he's like super, I feel like, I don't know if it's fair. He acts the most disillusioned to me out of all of the characters. Like, the other ones seem like they know what they're trying to do and where they're going to a certain, Malcolm has his issues because he's in that whole transitionary period. But like, Malcolm had all of this respect for Jim Brown in the movie. Like, he's like, look at him. He's helping the black businesses and he has control of this. And like, Jim Brown is like, I do not have control. he's like, no, it's not what y'all think it is. And that was like I have by no means reached that point in my life, but like, I that part really resonated with me too, of like, your precarity. Like, even when you have success, even when you have so-called influence, how your success depends on white institutions and white structures in a way. And how it recreates it. Because he's like, right now, all of our checks, except for Sam Cooke, that's the only one that Jim Brown like really sought out for, because he had more control over his like economic decision making. But he was like, for the rest of us, our checks are coming from white people. And Malcolm didn't have a job. Let me, we'll get to that later.
And that's the next theme.
You reckon, like, it's like you get to another stage of the game. And like, you realize that there's a whole bunch of more levels. Like, that's what kind of like the analogy that I would, like, you think you beat the game, and there's actually, this happened to me in real life. I thought I had beat the game because it made it like it was the final boss, and literally there was 20 more hours for me to go. And that's like how it is, where it's like, you're not even close. And so,
who did that? Nintendo?
Nintendo! Yeah, Nintendo been on both, but we'll get into it. But yeah, no, I think that his disillusionment and how he's kind of like trying to put them onto game, I would almost call it, where he's like, you think that this is freedom. You think that I'm doing more than I am doing and that I have more control than I have.
It remains a theme like throughout the movie for him to keep reminding them in little ways that when it comes down to the nitty gritty, I don't have control over these certain things.
Muhammad Ali is like, you know what I mean? He just had this huge career win. Like he's at the height of his, you know, like he had a really, really big moment in the movie. And he's kind of, and he's also the youngest. Yeah. And he's like, nobody could tell me anything. He's like, Jim Brown's like, it's not, your checks are still coming from white men. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you're not, mm-hmm. you're not in this liberated position that you think you are.
Mm-hmm. So our next theme is power and influence, which sort of connects to the last theme. Like you said, there's a scene in the movie where Jim Brown is, and Malcolm are sort of arguing, and then Jim Brown finally gets frustrated and fires back at Malcolm, "You ain't got no job, nigga," because he didn't.
And then, in the movie, they have Malcolm crying. I can't. He said
Malcolm was crying. Oh my!
He God. Had to take a moment.
That humanity, though.
That humanity. Because, I mean, at this point in the movie, he was talking hella shit. Like, he was really laying in to Sam Cooke. Mm-hmm. Sam Cooke had to leave because he got frustrated. Jim Brown basically is like, it's more complicated than you think it is. Then he's like, no, it's not, blah, blah. He's like, you don't got,
you got no job.
Because at that point, he had lost his platform. Like, he couldn't speak with the Nation of Islam.
Right. And that also was, like, one of those institutions that was sort of, like, bolstering him. Like, in just the same way mm-hmm. that Jim Brown always talks about, oh, yeah, these institutions bolster you, and they give you, they kind of will give you the power and influence that you have, but it can be so easily shipped away if you fall out of favor with them. Mm. So, but Malcolm and Sam's debate, too, was sort of similar in the sense that Malcolm is trying to tell Sam that, like, he isn't doing enough with his power and influence. So, like, outside of, like, you know, how much power and influence do you really have being mm-hmm. a theme, another part of the power and influence theme is, like, what is doing enough with your power and influence? Oh, oh my God. I'll just say it. Like, Malcolm and I were just talking about how we saw on the news, you know, Lil Uzi got the $24 million diamond and planted it in his forehead.
It looks so bad. I hope he's okay. It looks painful. That made my head hurt when I saw it.
The diamond looks nice. But what I was saying was, like, Lil Uzi got this $24 million implanted in his head. And, you know, having power and influence, like, in terms of, like, ideology and leadership is different than money in many ways. But mm-hmm. I was, like, talking about, oh, my God, did you see the Lil Uzi do this? And I was like, well, first of all, why would you even do that? Second of all, think about how many people he could have helped. And then I stopped myself. I was like, no, I'm not even going to do that right now. Because it's just like, it's too much to think about, like, mm-hmm. you know, like, what they could be doing with it versus what they are doing with it. Like, what should they be doing? You know, is it better for them to do this? Does this make them a bad person? But what I'm really talking about is, like, this whole debate between Malcolm and Sam. And Sam basically is saying that, oh, you know, I make this kind of music because it's fun and it's inspiring to the Black community, regardless of whether or not I'm doing protest music or, like, making music about the Black struggle and things
mm-hmm,
like that.
Mm-hmm.
My presence as a Black singer, you know, singing about what he wants to is inspiring in and of itself. But Malcolm keeps arguing that he needs to be doing more.
Protest.
Like, you know, that's not enough.
Just more in general.
You have to. And we were just talking about this earlier when it came to when we were talking about the whole humanity piece,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
like how we feel like you shouldn't always have to dedicate everything that you do to struggle, you know, as a Black person, because, you know, that's we weren't born to do that. And, like, we don't have to dedicate
all of our life and passion
to that.
Because, like, even in the and what's portrayed in the movie, like, Malcolm is, like, making his points, and he starts playing Sam Cooke's records, and then, like, and it's supposed to be, like, a drag, like, your music isn't deep enough. Mm-hmm. And then Muhammad Ali is like, oh, this is my song. I don't know if you remember. He's our
song. That's a great example.
Like, another thing that he says is, like, Muhammad Ali says is that, like, he's like, the Beatles or whatever. Like, he said, they're funny. I thought that was funny that they had him say that. They wrote that as a line. They're like, those British boys are funny, but they're like, they won't ever be Sam Cooke. It kind of, like, talking about, like, I mean, I think it is an open question of, like, should he have done more? And obviously he ends up doing more. He ends up, you know, the song we all know, "I Was Born by the River." let me, I don't know why that bastardization of it came into my mind. I was born by the river.
Came into my, I was shaking that ass.
Listen.
Bending over popping pussy, I was making that cash. Nah.
This is
a, but you see,
a
that
change
matters
is gonna
too.
Come is the name of the song.
That, but the remix matters too. That's what we're saying. Okay?
Listen, that is what we're saying. The remix matters. Let me stop. No, but there's place for love songs. Like we love Luther and Whitney. Whitney was not known for social commentary. She didn't do very much social commentary in her music at all. But her music is like, you know, people play it all the time. It's so meaningful for so many people.
Yeah.
And she remains an
inspiration.
Exactly.
Regardless.
We need black wedding songs. We need black for something for them to bump in the club. Like, we need all of that. That is part of black culture. That's part of the black experiences. But I feel like I did want to ask, I don't know if this should be in the next section. I wonder, like, in like how you use your power influence and the risk that comes with it is kind of like the sacrifices. Like what comes with leveraging your power? Because Malcolm was facing the decision. Like, he's like, if he goes against Elijah Muhammad, there will be blowback. And he's aware of that. And he's contemplating, like, he's strategizing with his wife. That's also a scene in the movie. And we all know this happens in real life too. Of like, so this is what's going to happen if I beef with Elijah Muhammad. And it did have consequences. We would be lying if there was not. I mean, it literally, like, the falling out with the Nation of Islam and the Nation of Islam antagonizing him was part of how he died.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there, of course, was collaboration and manipulation on the hands of the U.S. state, for sure. But, like, the Nation of Islam was definitely a player in his death. And so, like he literally paid the ultimate price, I would say, for sticking to his guns, for, like, nope, this is wrong, this is not agreeing with my spirit. Malcolm was calling for people to, like, really push themselves and kind of make the ultimate sacrifice in their own respective ways. Should we ask everyone to do that is one question. But, like, he did do it, and he impacted a lot of people.
Yeah.
How do we talk about the risk and, like, using... Because that's just something that kept coming up, like, Sam Cooke's character. Actually, I think Jim Brown says, too, is, like, that's going to put a target on my back. You know what I mean? And so I was just wondering, like, your thought on, like, the sacrifices that come with how you, like, use your power and influence.
Well, this is kind of going into the next section.
Yeah, okay.
I think this sort of is touching on our next theme, which is, like, what is black liberation? And, like, what does that really look like? So Malcolm leaving the Nation to lead his own organization puts him further in harm's way. But at the end of the movie, we'll go ahead and just bring this in. Malcolm said this in 1965, 2 days before he was assassinated. He said, "It is a time for martyrs now, and if I am to be one, it will be for the cause of brotherhood. That's the only thing that can save this country." A really, I think, a poignant quote to include, especially considering we kind of witness the brotherhood between these men throughout the movie. And then he's sort of saying, it's like he didn't say, oh, it'll be the cause of, you know, black power. It'll be the cause of black liberation. He said brotherhood, because, like, when you boil it down, that's what it is. It's just family. Like, this is your family. This is your nation. Like, whether or not they're, like, your nuclear family and who, you know, who you were born to. This is your family. This is your blood. So you care about them. And that's his motivation for going so hard, because to him, these people are all his brothers. Right. So I definitely understand, like, where he was coming from when it came to his perspectives on being a martyr and death. But honestly, that's not something that I aspire to. You know, like, it's like,
sorry, so I'm not trying to die.
Yeah, like, what is black liberation? And if it involves me, like, resigning to the fact that I could die. I mean, I could die. I mean, shit, knock on wood. But, like, I could die
at
any moment,
anyway.
Yeah,
we can die at any point. Especially at the hands of the
state. But it's like, I would like to reduce my chances of dying, you know, at a young age. And for him, you know, he said this is the only thing that can save this country. I think what he was really saying was brotherhood is the only thing that can save this country. Like, does that have to necessarily mean, and, you know, by brotherhood, of course, you know, we can sort of assume that he also meant sisterhood. I don't know.
or family. Another thing to unpack.
Like,
but yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, that aside, I think he was really saying, like, it's our love for one another is what will save us. If it's our love for one another that is going to save us, that love of self has to be there too. Like, you can't love other people so much, at least for me. I don't want to love other people so much that I'm going to hurt myself. Of course, it's one thing if, like, if I had a kid or if I, you know, yeah, if I had a kid, that'd probably be it, you know. That's probably the only person I would die for. You know?
I think a way I think about it is this idea of, like, a communal responsibility. Because, like, that's really what abolition is rooted in, too. Mm-hmm. In love and building community so we can move forward and envision a new future. Malcolm was very on similar logics towards the end of his journey on life. But, like, a way that I think about it to respond directly to what you're saying with the selfish, like, the caring for others versus caring for self is that, like, you are also a part of a community. And so by caring for a community, like, community care is self-care. Our version of liberation necessitates that we include ourselves in it. Mm-hmm. The future that we envision includes us because we are also part of the community along with the other people that we are caring for.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, I'm thinking about the Black Lives Matter movement. Uh-huh. And how it's fitting that this would be like the movement of the modern day, of the current times, because it really centers Black lives. Like, what it centers is us staying alive. That's mm-hmm. what it centers. And, like, Malcolm's quote, it's like he's saying it's going to be necessary at some point for some people to die for this. And I think we're sort of moving away from that sentiment. It now is more like, no one should have to die for this. Like, that's the whole point. We shouldn't have to die for this. You know the fuck? Like, that's not liberation. Like, us dying for this is not liberation. That's the opposite of liberation, because we want to live. That's why we're doing this. We want to live. So, like, even our leaders, you know, if we were to, even though it's more decentralized now, but even if we were to have big leaders, even the figures that we do have that speak out a lot for us, we don't want to see them die. Of course, we don't want to see them die, obviously, but I feel like it just needs to be said, like, really explicitly, really, like, we want to protect these leaders. They always say, as soon as someone, you know, is making a documentary about Dr. Sebi, oh, protect...
Kenny?
Nipsey.
Oh, true. You know, I think on that topic and thinking about what is Black liberation, how do we move forward, and this is a very big question, and there is lots of different schools of thought, and it's constantly evolving. Like, I think that answer is always being answered by the community. But I feel like something that we learn from the idea of, like, transformative justice, there has to be a space for reconciliation. And I mm-hmm. think that's something that I wanted to bring up in the movie, because it's like they were beefing. We've talked explicitly about them beefing in this movie, like arguing with each other. The thing is that there was this grounding of respect for each other. Mm-hmm. And of caring about each other to this point of us, like, having to die, like, even, like, with the idea that certain people are enemies, as far as this is a black only conversation, I'm talking about Black people, like, there's certain people who are enemies to the movement, there are certain people that just need to go. Something that people talk about with transformative justice, you don't wait mm-hmm. for the abuse to happen, you don't wait for the harm to happen for you to start building community and for start building that core of caring for each other. Because it's like, when you build that community, and what I mean by community is, like, mm-hmm. that we all love and respect each other, even when someone does harm, they're still a member of the community. I just feel like the idea that, like, there needs to be martyrs, that we need to call for people to be martyrs, is kind of adding, like, a layer of disposability. It's not saying how we can all protect each other and how we can make sure that each other are okay as we move right. forward. And so,
and that's what I feel like the Black Lives Matter is sort of like movement is nailing a bit more. You know, they're mm-hmm. like nailing the concept that, like, no, we need to protect each other for real. Like, we don't want any martyrs. We
exactly.
want to make, like, it through this. Yeah.
You are not counting on this larger than life figure to be Jesus, to be a messianic figure, to absolve all of our sins and carry all of our burdens. The only way that we can be free, to that Malcolm X quote, is by actually building real community with each other so that we can have a future where we all get to be together and we get to be alive together. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's obviously yeah. lofty, but you need to have a vision to move forward is what I think. So I don't care.
I think that's beautifully said. So the last thing we want to touch on is how we memorialize Black leaders. What inspired this theme that we pulled was the tendency for us to attach Black leaders to, like, the most controversial part of their life. Like, for example, Martin Luther King, he was labeled as an assimilist, a pacifist, even though that isn't a holistic take on his entire career of being a civil rights leader. Of course, many people know that, especially towards the end of his career, he was having a lot of second thoughts about the way that he had been approaching the movement. So the whole assimilist pacifist label isn't completely accurate to describe him as a, I mean, it may be accurate for certain parts of his career or certain aspects of himself, but it isn't a holistic look. And then Malcolm, he was labeled as being militant. He was labeled as being too aggressive and
he certainly
too
was.
Militant and yeah, and
for portions
he was,
of his life.
They said that he encouraged violence and things like that. But even with breaking with the Nation of Islam, he started to change a lot of his ideologies. You know, that's just labeling him as militant isn't a completely accurate.
It's a bit reductive.
Holistic look at his
right.
Yeah, completely reductive. And of course, you were talking about earlier how before he joined the Nation of Islam, before he was a Muslim. You know, he lived a completely different life too. So he was out here
scamming.
Would you say he lived a full life?
Yes, he didn't live long enough, but he lived.
Oh life. Yeah, of course he didn't. Yeah. He didn't live long, nearly long enough.
There's a lot we can learn from the. I'm gonna use that word again because I like it. Ideological refinement, but there's like. You read and you have your experiences, which motivates your action, which motivates how you engage with the world and how you pursue your particular version of Black liberation. Mm-hmm. And you learn from your experiences as you do your work. You're like, oh, this isn't the way I thought it was. Mm-hmm. And you evolve, or you talk to more people, or you read more stuff, and you continue to evolve your perspective to account for the complexity of the world. Something that I notice is the tendency to kind of taking an ideological snapshot of a person and staying there. Like another mm-hmm. example who comes to mind is Du Bois. And Du Bois, a lot of people mm-hmm. cite him for the talented 10th and that kind of Black mm-hmm. elitist ideal that he did have. It's not a lie. It's not misconstruing the information, but he had that and he tried it out. And he recognized the limits, from his experience of being in academia and dealing with white people and white institutions, he recognized the limits of so-called Black elites being able to enact the type of change he was seeing. And his focus became a lot more grassroots. It became a lot more pan-African. It's funny because him and Malcolm X Malik Shabazz ended in a very, very similar place ideologically. And he actually, Du Bois wrote a book. Basically debunking a lot of that elitist assimilationist ideology that he had espoused for a portion of his life. And people still, when they talk about Du Bois, whether it's for good or bad, whether they're trying to critique him or praise him or use him to justify something, they'll cite something like the talented 10th. And it's Du Bois didn't fuck with the concept of the talented 10th when he moved forward. Mm-hmm. Du Bois himself did not agree with that. You know what I mean? So I just feel you don't have to agree with these figures, but I just feel understanding them holistically when it comes to their ideologies is really important. We can learn from the past in that way, where it's someone tried this and literally the person who was the proponent, the architect of a certain idea is this ain't it. And it's I feel we need to be able to talk about that. Martin Luther King talking about, I feel I've led my people into a burning building, and him being a communist at the end of his life. But I just think it's very reductive. I would almost say disrespectful. I might be doing too much with that. But I feel it's disrespectful to reduce them. I see lots of people when they quote these people, it's that's when they were almost, they're at a very ideologically immature part of their life that they would call it. They would define it that way. And it's and you're making that their whole legacy. And I feel they would be rolling in their graves by seeing that.
I think in terms of the movie itself, like we said with the whole, in the humanizing section, they do their best to detach them from these stereotypes. So, this movie maybe is making an attempt at memorializing these Black leaders in a way that we haven't been able to through non-fictional and events that actually happen, those kinds of movies, because a lot of those are really limited. So, they sort of took the limits off by saying, we're not going to necessarily base it on something that actually happened, but sort of imagine, this this kind of casual night. And even the moment when Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, is sitting on that bed, and the bodyguard comes in there and sitting on the bed with, who's he sitting with? Jim Brown. And they're taking mm-hmm. swigs of the, the flask, and when the bodyguard comes in, and who happens to be Muslim as well, and Cassius is about to convert, and he's asking him questions about oh, you know, do you regret anything about it? You know, what do you miss? Do you miss anything? Do you miss, you know, certain pleasures of life that you, you know, you don't do when you're Muslim and things like that? Just little moments like that just allow you to peek into, like, maybe what might have been going on in their psyches, their way contemplating these decisions that they're making, you know, because I'm sure there's a lot of prayer and thought and meditation that went into Muhammad Ali's decision to, I mean, at the peak of his career, to come out as Muslim. I say come out, but, you know, come out as Muslim.
Yeah, I get what you mean.
And to change... and to completely change his name, like, it's an extremely brave move, but, you know, there's a lot of thought that went into that, even beyond how he felt as a public figure, but, like, you know, is this really gonna fit with me as a person and who I am and, like, you know, what I want to do and what I want to be? That's a moment that stood out to me in terms of memorializing these leaders and allowing them even more nuance in the way that we memorialize them. And then another moment that stood out to me was the performance of A Change Is Gonna Come at the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm,
we see him performing it on live television, and actually I found out that, you know, through researching it after the movie, I found out that the real Sam Cooke actually performed A Change Is Gonna Come only once live before he passed away, and the recording, which was broadcasted on television like it was in the movie, was actually destroyed. Now, there was some of the people, I was actually on a little Reddit thread reading about this, but some of the people were saying, oh, it was kind of commonplace back then. They didn't really save recordings. It wasn't like the obsession with, like, keeping everything in, like, you know, everything documented wasn't as strong back then. But it's still telling that such a huge monumental moment for the Black community, like, it wasn't seen as important enough to keep that, just keep that tape so we can have it for later. But this movie, I mean, the actor performed it live and reenacted how the performance may have looked, even though we don't have the tape now. And I think that's another way that they sort of, like, creatively memorializing these leaders and, like, oh, he didn't get the chance to have that tape of him last for generations, for children to watch for generations to come. But we're going to do what we can with this movie to give him that moment, even though it's not going to be the same as if it was real. But yeah, there's just a few ways I feel like the movie makes an effort to memorialize these leaders in ways that really does them justice and doesn't reduce them to the most controversial parts of themselves, or the parts that people like to attach themselves to and, like, label them as.
Yeah, that was amazing. I love that.
Well, thanks.
I think we're ready to answer the question. Was this movie necessary? Was there a point to it?
Oh, do you want me to start?
I can start. So I think it did. I think this movie did matter. I think it serves a purpose. I feel like the intellectual exercise of taking all of these things into account and trying to forge our own future, like, I feel like that's what we need to be doing. I feel like, of course, you can't take this movie by itself, but, like, if it makes you stop and think of the complexity, I feel like it highlights the complexity of these figures, and it provides us with a way to challenge ourselves and to challenge what we think of people. And so I think it was, I feel like it served an amazing purpose in that regard. I'm pro this movie. I think even this discussion that we have was very helpful, like, because these things have been, like, heavy on my mind lately.
Yeah.
Like, more, I mean, it's always on my mind. I'm a Black person in the work that I do. And it's like, I just feel like for the past couple of weeks, it's been, like, intense. And I feel like this movie kind of connected to the fact that, like, it was reassuring to see people who came before me, like, how thinking about how they would grapple with this. Like, I feel like it kind of gets into that idea of ancestral veneration, where it's like, we don't have to figure out the answer on our own. And it's like, and I think going through the intellectual, like, the people who wrote this movie, of going through the exercise, and kind of we even did it to a certain degree in this podcast, but going through the exercise of, like, how would our ancestors deal with this?
Mm-hmm.
And what can we learn from that? Because it's like the conversation is like a conversation that you and I had, like, last week.
Yeah, we talk all the time. We're talking about, like, what is our place in the Black liberation movement? How much should I be dedicating to this movement? And I was even saying to Malcolm, I was saying, like, you know, I don't really want to live my life dedicated to rectifying all the wrongs that white people have done to me. Like, why is it that they get to they get to ruin all of our lives, and then we have the burden of fixing it. So it's like, not only am I already carrying the burden of racism, marginalization, oppression, all that stuff, but I'm also carrying the burden of fixing it. That's not how I want to live my life. Oh my God. Like, if I was going to do that my whole life until I die, like, that sounds like a miserable existence to me. And I just don't, like, that's just not how I personally want to live my life. Like, it could be different for anybody. And like, if that's like your path, that's completely fine. The conversations that they were having, like, were really resonated with me because, you know, I grapple a lot with how depressing, you know, all this stuff is every day, because mm-hmm. I mean, like you said, it takes a toll on you, especially when it's your line of work, the manifestations of the oppression of Black people and things like that. So yeah, for, you know, it definitely served its purpose in the sense that it was like, I felt like I could relate to the conversations that they were having, and to mm-hmm. see people who, you know, I see as like, you know, legends larger than life, you know, having these conversations that like, that we have, it was encouraging to know that, or it was encouraging to see a portrayal of them that wasn't sure, like that wasn't like steadfast in their path mm-hmm. and completely like standing strong in their purpose and knowing that they're on the right path, because so much, especially, you know, as a 20 something young Black person living in the year 2021 with all everything that's going on, all I have to say is 2020 or 2021, and you already know it's a struggle. So it's like, it was good to see that for me. So like, even though it wasn't a true story, it did serve a purpose, you know, for me, in terms of knowing that it's okay to have these questions and to figure it out, and to mm-hmm. not always be completely sure what your role in the Black liberation movement is. Because I feel like Black people do have a compulsion to, you know, or feel the need to contribute in some way just because they're Black and they love these
people. Because we be suffering, you know? Though, and you don't want other people to suffer. But it's like, I feel like literally doing this, like I literally had a conversation with my mom about my great-grandmother, because my mom talks about my great-grandmother all the time, and my dad talks about my great-grandfather, and like, I've had conversations mm-hmm. with both of them where I'm like, how would they think about this, like, you know what mm-hmm. I mean, like, in all the lessons that they've learned and how you think of them, and it's like kind of like relying on that wisdom of the past, because you're still gonna have to figure it out, like they can't give you the answer per se, but they can help you get closer. I feel like by relying on community and relying on our ancestors, we are able to forge a path forward in moving forward. Because it's like, if you put it all on yourself, you're not going to succeed and you're going to kill yourself. You know, like, counterproductive to me. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This movie showcases the importance of your community. That's why this movie matters. Because we would see these guys sitting on these lecterns by themselves and speaking to these big crowds and just seeming like they have it all together. But their support system is the reason why they're able to do that in the first place. And it's going to be the same thing for us. We need that strong support system. We need that strong community to accomplish anything. Whether or not you want to go on to be, quote unquote, the next Malcolm X, or if you just want to not engage in discourse this year and you just want to look pretty, you know, that your community
is going to, or you want to make that shucking and jiving music. You right, know.
Yeah. So, yes, this movie does matter. And the thing is, with fiction, you have to make it matter. Mm-hmm, and they mm-hmm. succeeded.
Yeah.
That's the verdict.
So, yeah. If you've listened to this whole podcast and you haven't seen the movie, go watch it for yourself. We would love to hear
what I don't you know think. Why you would do that, but I guess if you don't want to watch
well, I'd be doing stuff like that. People would be like, don't go watch the movie. I'll be watching the whole video.
Don't watch it.
Listen to the whole podcast. That'd be me. So if you made it to this point and you like me, I hope that you feel, we encourage you to watch the movie, and you may have different take than us, but I feel like the conversation that it's spurring on is productive and generative. And so, yeah,
please let us know if you do. Oh yeah. I was going to say, please let us know. If you're listening and you do watch a movie because of this podcast, please let us know. Shoot us a DM on Instagram or comment on one of our posts or whatever. And we have a Discord too, so we don't really use it, but you know, we could always discuss something.
We're going to figure it out, though. So, yeah, maybe we can start a conversation or something.
Yeah. So, let me do the org of the week real quick. You know, we always do the absolutely ghetto org of mm-hmm. the week. And this week is going to be the Organization of Black Screenwriters. So, the Organization of Black Screenwriters, and I'm going to go ahead and quote the president, which is Black woman Jennifer Williams. And she says that here at the Organization of Black Screenwriters, we are moving this organization to build visibility in the industry. And we're pushing out original works, pilots, features, as well as casting actors, crew, and directing and shooting content for all of their platforms, and also pushing Black talent, Black screenwriting talent, out to be on their platforms, which is their TV network, OBS TV, their webcasts, etc., to mainstream and like Hollywood productions as well. So basically, their organization is dedicated to just giving Black screenwriters more visibility. I thought this would be a good organization to highlight today, because without screenwriting, this movie couldn't have existed, because it is a fictional account. So the creativity that it took to come up with this story, like I said, sort of like build this like this AI movie, all props to the screenwriters. And I encourage you, if you're interested in writing or screenwriting at all, just go ahead and check them out. Maybe you can connect with them and find some resources for yourself, because this organization is really based on providing Black screenwriters with the support network and the resources to get their voices heard and their work out there. You can find them at www.obswriter.com. That's obswriter.com. They're on Twitter as obswriter, and we're going to link everything in the description box. We'll link the Amazon Prime link for this movie if you want to go watch it. We'll also link the articles that we reference, because there's a couple articles. Check out the show notes. Yeah, that's it.
All right, y'all. Well, thanks for staying with us. Hopefully you got something out of it.
Yes. And thank you for staying with us, and stay ghetto.
Bye, y'all.
Bye.